life better than bacon and lettuce and homegrown tomatoes. Up in the morning, out in the garden, get you ripe when you don't get a hard one. Plant them in the spring.
Support for In the Garden comes from the Flower Farm with a new shipment of marguerite daisies, colorful baskets, vegetables, perennials, and bedding plants. Also trees, shrubs, and soil amendments. Open every day except Wednesday at 6 Rory Road, Papke's Landing. Good afternoon. Welcome to KFSK's In the Garden. I'm your host, Mindy Anderson, and with me on the line all the way from maybe sunny Juneau, maybe raining. I don't know. Let's find out with Ed Byarski. Hello, Ed.
Hi there, Mindy. And it is partly sunny. Just wait a moment, and it'll be cloudy. It's been back and forth. A little light rain this morning. Pretty good day considering what is on the forecast for the next few weeks. Next week. Should be moist, it appears.
That's what we're getting down here on this end, too. Moist weather for the future. But that's okay. We're going to still garden.
It is. Yeah, I'm planting. As soon as I get home, I've got some soaked pea seeds to plant. Hopefully they will take off and grow. And the peas that I planted way back, the end of February, are flowering. So next week I will have peas to eat. And then we'll have a second crop probably in August. So that's a good thing.
That's exciting news. That sounds great. That sounds great. So are you keeping away the bugs and the pests and all of that from your plants?
Keeping away, no, I can't say that. I am noticing pests and bugs of various sorts. One of the big things that everybody around Southeast Alaska should be noticing, if they haven't already, is all the spruce needles falling off the spruce trees, which are a result of the spruce aphids, and that's a result of, well, partially, caused by the mild winters that we've had. These spruce aphids attack the old needles, last year's needles and older, since there's anywhere from 3 to 4 years of needles on most evergreens.
Mm-hmm.
And they go after the old ones, where not the new sprouts now. So the result is, anyway, they suck the juices out of the needles, needles die, and then a lot of them, well, most all of them, fall off prematurely, where normally, so you may get 2 or 3 years worth of needles falling off all at once. So if folks are noticing on ponds and puddles, on driveways, sidewalks, wherever, there are a lot of spruce needles out there.
Yes.
And I've had folks ask, well, is that a bad thing? And it's a maybe on that. So the new growth is coming out strongly, but of course it makes the trees look kind of thin. If this goes on, well, it has already been going on for a couple of years, but if it goes on for more, 3 or 4 or 5 years, yes, the trees can be weakened to the point where some may very well die. Hard to say. Little birds are actively out there picking, you know, trying to pick off this tiny little aphids, but these are tinier than most. I mean, these are the size. If you look at spruce, some, you know, low-growing tree, and look at the undersides of the needles, these are tiny little black to brown specks. They are really small. So, again, it's going to be, it isn't something that we can really do much about. There aren't really any pesticides we can spray on. We wouldn't want to be spraying anything on an 80-foot tree anyway. But, you know, we're pretty much going to have to live with it.
So, Ed, when the needles fall off, and so could we pick some needles up from the ground and put them in our hand and maybe get out the little magnifying glass and see if we can't find some on these needles, or will they go off and go somewhere else?
Well, no, you may well see some, and they, you know, normally what they'll do, where they will overwinter or where they will survive, they will lay their eggs in the bark of the tree.
Okay.
And then they emerge, strangely enough, but they emerge in the wintertime if we got a mild winter. So if we had cold winters, as we used to have in the good old days, I mean like 20, 30 years ago when I first moved to Alaska, Many or most would be killed off. There'd still be a few here that would survive, but a string of mild winters keeps them alive. So, yeah, if you want to take a look, and you're probably better off rather than on the needles that are already on the ground, go to a small tree or low branches where you see some browning needles, some that don't look that healthy. And look at those are where you're more likely to see some of these tiny little brown specks. I mean, I had a lady had a tree she was concerned about. This actually was one of the ornamental weeping Norway spruce. And when I looked at it, it too was infested. So it isn't exclusive to our Sitka spruce. But I don't know how many more other kinds of spruce might be affected by the same little bug.
Do they know how these aphids or these little, how did they get here? Did they come from other plants that were shipped up here, or is it something that has been here a long time?
Most likely a native insect that, again, was relatively kept under control by what used to be normal winters. You know, normally we used to get, I mean, when I lived in Petersburg, it got down to 10 to 15 degrees below back in the 80s, and colder than that, you know, earlier. And you and we haven't seen that, those kind of temperatures in quite a few years. So that has allowed them to multiply, just like up north where they've got the spruce bark beetles. Again, those are native insects that with the milder winters, they have survived, and warmer summers.
Uh-huh.
So they're here, and we pretty much have to live with them.
Okay, we're going to take phone calls. If anyone has a gardening question for Ed, you can call in here to In the Garden at 772-3808 or 888-772-3808. Give us a call if you're by your phone. What other pests should we be looking out for right now, Ed?
Well, this time of year, certainly the other aphids you're likely to find aphids on wild plants such as the fireweed. If you look closely, although they don't do enough damage to make a difference, but if you look closely at thick patches of buttercups, which are an imported weed too, there you'll likely see these white kind of fuzzy patches. Almost kind of looks like a white mold, especially down near the base if they're growing in thick grass or just thick patches of buttercups as they are. And there's actually a woolly aphid there that can be attacking those. There's another one kind of similar up in alder trees. Again, that's kind of a white woolly aphid. Sometimes you'll actually see these things flying through the air. You know, they get blown out of the trees by the breeze, and birds are trying to catch them. I've had them land on me or on my clothing, so I see them that way. Columbines are another plant that often gets aphids, very common. So at least for aphids, and, well, we'll lump these in with the currant worm, the European currant worm, which has begun attacking the gooseberries first. That's their favorite food. From there, they may move over to red currants, which is kind of second favorite. They don't much go for the black currants, and if you've ever smelled black currant leaves or crushed them, they're very aromatic, very musky smelling. So it may be that there's something repellent about that variety. But the treatment, you'll see them for what you usually notice is one day it looks like, you know, the gooseberry bush is nice and healthy, green leaves and all that. And the next day, wow, what happened to the leaves? It looks like they've been skeletonized. All that's left are the veins, these little greenish, green and white and black caterpillars up to a half to three quarters of an inch long are just munching away, eating out everything in between the veins. They leave the tougher veins there. So seems like they come out very quickly. So with those critters we talk about in the fall, you should have cleaned up underneath, raked the leaves away underneath them. If you can put a good solid mulch underneath the gooseberries and currants, that's great. Otherwise, loosen things up in the spring for the little birds to come along and scratch up the larvae, which then emerge after it gets warm enough and goes to the nearest gooseberry bush or a red currant bush, lays its eggs, and they're off and running again or off and crawling again. to combat these are soap spray. We've talked about using soap spray before. It's nice, easy, safe stuff, cheap, you know, the price is right. Just liquid soap, you know, a liquid lawn, liquid dish soap will work. There are insecticidal soaps, safer soaps, and some others. But look at the directions. Usually they call for about a teaspoon or two in a quart of water. Or if you've got a lot to spray, you know, you can mix up more in gallons of water. And you have to spray them on the bugs. That this is not a repellent that you can just spray on the leaves and hope they're not going to eat them. But you actually need to spray the insects, and it does kill the insects quickly. The soap just dehydrates them. I mean, the soap penetrates their skins and dehydrates them. And you'll probably see with current worms, at least, on a bush, you'll probably see them fall off.
Okay.
And they make writhe around on the ground and look like they're in terrible pain, but it's hard to be sympathetic.
Yeah. So, yeah, the current worms, are they kind of, you said they're kind of globbed together a little bit?
Well, often you may very well see, depending on the size of the leaf, you may see three or four caterpillars on one leaf. And then when they finish whatever they get from that leaf, they'll move on to another one, assuming that their brothers and sisters haven't chewed those out. So, I mean, they'll move up and down the bush to the next batch of leaves if the mother didn't lay eggs on all of the leaves. So they'll move along until they get large enough. They molt once or twice till they get up to a certain size, and then they fall off into the soil and where they burrow in and pupate until next year. So, again, that's why we talk about doing the cleanup work. If you can kill them off now, of course, that's a plus, but then you've got to be diligent about watching for them. So here I'm over in Douglas across the bridge from Juneau, where last week I saw some of these current worms on the gooseberry, which made me start to look at my own, and mine weren't quite as advanced in the size of the berries that are already on them. And I haven't seen current worms there yet, but I'm assuming I will, because we had them last year and the year before. So I'm going to just be ready. I've got the sprayer ready and mix up some of the soap spray and give them a shot. And I'll try to work them over pretty thoroughly as much as possible to spray across the whole thing top to bottom. And then watch and give it a couple of days, and then check again to see if there are more. Because very often, you know, I'm going to miss a few. I'm sure I will. And it's possible that a later insect may come along and lay more eggs. So, you know, the first batch are from one or several insects that emerge, and maybe a few days later some more will. So usually this takes, if we do this kind of watch and spray over the course of 2 weeks, that'll normally take care of it for the season, and then they will be done at least.
Okay, that's good news. Are they on any other plants that we should be looking at?
Well, what I wonder is, and I have never read and I have never noticed that, although it would make sense that they might attack. We have multiple species of wild currants around us. There's a kind of little creeping, trailing currants. There's the, sometimes they're called a wild spiny currant or a wild gooseberry, and they've got these brown spines, lots of spines, compared shorter spines, but more of them than the standard domestic gooseberries. And then there's what some folks call stink currants. Again, I've never seen currant worms on those. If times got tough, perhaps they would go to those. So, I mean, they are called imported European currant worms, so I would assume that they came in with gooseberries or currants that someone brought from down south.
Okay. What about other pests? Aphids, currant worms, anything else we should kind of keep an eye out for? Of course, different aphids in our greenhouse.
Right, there may be, and there may be thrips in the greenhouse, and I can hope you don't get white flies. Thrips are tiny, tiny, tiny black little insect. They don't fly, but they hop. But what you notice with those, and I unfortunately have managed to get them on my basil again. I've got something in the house that is an overwintering host for these. So I grew my basil, and they were going up and looking nice, and then I started seeing white patches on the leaves where the the thrips are a juice. They kind of scrape and suck the juices out of leaves also, like kind of like the aphids. But they're really, really tiny. I mean, it's hard to see the little black specks, which is about what they are.
Uh-huh.
And so they are a problem. And there's, again, the soap spray can be used on those if you see them, but it can be tough. And I've gotten those on my cucumbers, which can be a real problem. The other one in the aphids in greenhouses and white flies, that's one which isn't common around here, luckily, but may come in with other plants from down south, so you've got to be careful. And sometimes you may have seen these sticky traps. They have white or yellow or blue chunks of plastic with sticky stuff like, they make something called tangle foot or tangle trap that they put on these. But you can make your own even and put on a little bit of Vaseline or even STP motor oil onto these pieces of the right color of plastic. And the different colors attract different pests. So it's usually yellow for aphids. I think it's blue for thrips. And I can't remember what the white cards, and you can buy these pre-sticky already. And they are really sticky with hangers that you can put in between to monitor pests. And again, using the soap spray can work. And I know that here in town there are, I don't know if you can get them there, but you can order them through the mail. At least for in a greenhouse where they're kind of confined, you can use ladybugs. And the ladybugs will go after aphids and kill and eat those. So that's outdoors, ladybugs will just fly off, disappear. But inside a greenhouse, that's a good location to use them. And I understand I'm going to go take a look today that I was told there's a big tree down in front of the New State Museum that is wrapped up with something like Rimae, and I guess apparently it got infested with aphids, and then they brought in a whole bunch of ladybugs, released them in underneath this big Rimae blanket, essentially, in the hopes that they'll kill off the insects inside there. So I'm going to go take a look and see if I can spot that one.
Okay, well, we have a caller, so let's take this first phone call. Actually, we have a couple calls, Ed. So let's take a break and take the call here on line one. Welcome to In the Garden.
Hi, I have I don't know if it's a beneficial pest or something else in my garden dirt. It doesn't matter if it's in an old potato box or a flower box. I'm finding some little tube-like worm, but it's not really a worm. It's kind of dark-colored, dark brown, ridges all the way around it, kind of pointed at both ends, doesn't move. But it's alive, and if I try to squish it, it is the toughest little bugger, but finally it'll squish and its insides comes out. I think it's some sort of a larva that's going to hatch and probably start eating my roots of my crops. Do you have any idea what it could be? And there's just, I've never seen so many. Sometimes there'll be a patch of 10 and sometimes just one or two here, but they're everywhere.
Okay. Is this, I've got a couple possibilities. Is it kind of a reddish brown, like you say, segmented worm, half inch to an inch long, roughly?
Yes, it is a reddish brown, but it doesn't seem to be a worm. But it looks like one at first look, but then it doesn't really wiggle around or anything.
I mean, you're describing it properly as a larva, and most likely it's commonly called wire worms. You may see the results of their chewing in potatoes where they will actually eat into a potato. The larva for most insects and such are the more destructive pest. Because once they mature and emerge into their adults, usually the adults are just there to breed and lay eggs and start the new generation. But it is the larvae that are the most destructive normally, other than something like aphids, which they just squirt out new aphids. They're smaller to larger, and then you get more and more faster than rabbits. But with the wireworms, they become click beetles. And if you've ever seen, they're a small, half-inch long, narrow beetle. If you happen to grab one, kind of weird, because if you hold them by the abdomen, you can actually, they will try to, it's like they snap their thorax back and and forth as if they were upside down and would literally flip themselves back right side up if they're on a hard surface.
Mm-hmm.
And those will chew also on, you know, so the larva will chew on a variety of root crops, like potatoes, carrots occasionally, and some other roots of plants. Then the adults, when they emerge, I've actually seen those, I've already seen them out, and they chew on some of the, actually in apple blossoms. I've actually taken them out of apple blossoms where I can see where they've chewed on the little stamens and the pistils of the apple blossom, which then, of course, prevents some of the fruit from forming, but there's plenty to go around there. They're native here. I know there have been studies done on them, toxic pests. There are pesticides for them. What you're doing by squishing them is the ideal situation because you're targeting the pest. I can't give you a recommendation for, don't know of any really safe and organic method of pest control. You might try Googling those and see about wireworm control as the to search for something that might work. So I can't be really optimistic, but they're here. And yeah, like you say, some years there's quite a lot of them.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and they're all buried in the ground about an inch to 3 inches or so. And they don't seem to, I think they're just waiting to hatch, but I would love to be able to get rid of them before they do hatch, but I guess I'll just keep on squishing them when I dig them up.
Right. Yeah, again, you know what, you're cultivating the soil, helps to dry out the soil, and again, of course, there are small birds that can come along if you've got some around there, small sparrows and robins and other things that will certainly scratch in the soil and potentially eat some of these at least.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, if they're 1 to 3 inches deep, they're pretty safe from most critters that might attack them. So I don't know if there's any, sometimes there are some bacterial or nematode controls which may be available for those, but just go and do a search on wireworm control and see what you find, I guess.
Okay, thank you, Ed. Have a good day now.
Bye-bye. You're welcome.
Thank you. Okay, Ed, we have another caller. Caller on line 3, welcome to In the Garden.
Hi, Ed. Hi, Mindy. How are you guys doing?
Hi.
Good. I just have a quick question for you guys. I need to pick the rhubarb, and I was wondering how far can you pick rhubarb, you know, so it doesn't say hurt the next crop coming up. I mean, how far can you pinch it back?
Okay, it's a good, common enough question. Certainly, you can. Around here, we're lucky enough that rhubarb will grow long into the summer if it's well fed. So, if you've got a good, healthy patch or clump of rhubarb, you can keep harvesting it. Usually into July at least, say for the next month or so, roughly. But we do want to leave some to grow and feed the roots for next year. And again, that's where I talk about, at least for me, I'm lucky enough to have my neighbor with horses, so I dump the horse manure on it, and that's usually enough to keep it well fed for a good amount of time. So just leave, if you want to be on the safe side, quit harvesting by mid-July or so, and then just let the plant die back. Again, throw compost on it. If you've got chicken manure, that's fine. Steer manure, that's good. Any of the compost is good also. But it is a heavy feeder.
I got some people that want some rhubarb, and they want a lot of it. So if I'm picking a plant that, say, has quite a few stalks and leaves, can I pick it down to, say, like, leave, say, 4 or 5 stalks on each plant? You don't want to, like, pick it down to it's bare. So, like, you know, there's probably a point where it's overpicking it, where it could distress the plant, right?
Right, exactly. So, again, you're going to be picking, normally you pick the biggest, oldest leaves and stems off, and then leave some of the young ones on there. But again, just finally quit picking anymore. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can pick it down pretty hard sometime because they, if you've ever dug up a rhubarb plant, they have huge roots that can store a lot of energy in them. Mm-hmm. But, and that, that also goes, it works the other way too. If you are moving, say you're dividing rhubarb and giving it to somebody else to grow some of their own, that normally they say the first year, so if you dug some out this spring and they planted that stuff, they wouldn't want to harvest any of that
right.
this year.
Right, I remember you saying that in the past.
And very lightly harvest it next mm-hmm. year so mm-hmm. that it can grow a good new big root system
right.
to feed it. You know, I don't know, how old is your patch? Is it a pretty old old clumps?
Oh, part of it is really old, and the others have been in 2-3 years. They've been divided and sifted the dirt out underneath them and cultivated them pretty good, and they've been fed fish food and stuff, so they're doing pretty well. So it's just that I have someone who wants a lot of rhubarb, and I just kind of wondered how far could you pick it down. You know, I was kind of thinking probably need to leave the younger stalks in there and few leaves so it can then regenerate and have, you know, it can spring back.
Yep. Yeah, pick it down, you know, leave a quarter of the leaves maybe, and let that grow. If they put out lots of new ones, again, you know, maybe you take only about half of it this time for the next picking. And then, if you have a big third picking, maybe then take a little bit less than that so to leave the rest of it there to grow for and store food for next year.
Oh, yeah, taper it back, right. That's a good idea. So the plant has its chance to build its winter reserves up, so, yeah.
Exactly, great.
Great. Well, thank you kindly.
Good luck.
All right, good luck with that.
Okay, thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye. I've been thinking about all the things I could make with rhubarb lately, too, and have to get out there and do some rhubarb harvesting and or put it in the freezer. But, yeah, love that rhubarb, and you make all kinds of great things with it.
It does do well here. Certainly it is a survivor in the old homestead. It likes the amount of rain we get, and, yeah, if we feed it enough, it'll give us a lot, certainly. And if we want to divide this stuff up, make more, certainly it's not a difficult plant to transplant either.
Another nice thing about rhubarb is when we're talking about pests, you know, it doesn't seem like we ever have a big problem with anything eating the rhubarb. It's nice.
Exactly. Other than, yeah, pretty much the only thing I see, and of course this, is, I guess, turns into an opportunity. Excuse me.
Yeah.
That I'll throw, you know, once I, when I pull my rhubarb stems off, snap the leaves off, usually I'll put the leaves down near the rhubarb, and then you can come back, and this kind of leads us into one of our often favorite topics, our slugs. And the slugs will eventually go after the dead leaves. They don't bother with the new stems and the healthy branches much. But they will chew on the dead leaves, or they'll hide out underneath it. So if you're looking for places to thin out the slug population, that's a good place to do it. You know, lift up the old rhubarb leaves. And then you can go underneath there and skewer them or snip them in half or spray the ammonia and water, our mixture on them, the half and half ammonia. And that works well. And it also has the effect of, it's a nitrogen fertilizer, so it actually helps to fertilize the rhubarb again. So that's beneficial. So again, you know, we are always talking about cleaning up the garden, cleaning up so that the soil, you know, pests that are maybe in the soil get turned over, maybe they'll dry out and that sort of thing. Well, again, all of that helps, too, with slugs turning the soil over, so hopefully it can dry out some. This makes it less hospitable to those little slimy critters that are all around us.
Ed, we have another caller. Let's take the caller on line one. Welcome to In the Garden.
Hi. Hey, I was wondering if you guys have talked about springtails yet.
Springtails?
Springtails, the little grub-like.
We haven't.
Critters that are in the soil.
Yeah, they're interesting ones, right? So those are a tiny, most often noticed early in the spring, and they are, they're on the weirdness scale. They're right up there, especially if you can watch them, or if you have them, particularly if you could have them underneath a dissecting microscope or something to actually watch them move.
Uh-huh.
You usually see them very often. You'll see them on little puddles of water in the spring where they get flooded out of the ground. They are they don't fly. They literally they have their tail kind of folds up underneath them. Yeah, what's the best? I mean, almost to describe them like a shrimp or a lobster can do. And but they move by flipping themselves, you know, flip with their tail down, like almost to spring and move and jump around on the soil surface. Normally, they live just under the soil surface. They feed on decaying matter and occasionally on some plant roots also. So there can be some, you know, some ill effects on, especially on tender young plants or young transplants or seedlings, as far as that goes. Again, control is would primarily be cultivation. They don't like dry soil. So if you had more sand in your soil, again, they like a really organic soil.
Okay. Okay.
So, again, there isn't normal. I don't recommend a particular any kind of pesticides or drenches for those particularly. So that's something just to be careful of. And one other common pest, and this tends to be more indoors than outdoors, are the fungus gnats that people may have noticed if they were growing transplants, growing seedlings and that sort of thing. And all of a sudden there's these tiny little black flies flying around, like if you disturb a pot or and this can be in the houseplants too.
Right.
So they've got these tiny little insects that fly around, and they, again, their larvae are in the soil, they feed on organic matter and a little bit on roots too. So those, there is a, I'm trying to remember the name of this stuff. It is a, usually a concentrated liquid, occasionally a powder that is used particularly against fungus gnats, and it's called Natrol, which is spelled G-N-A-T-R-O-L. And
okay.
That's something that you can mix up, you water into the soil, and then hopefully it kills the larva. The other thing you can do for those is to put a thin layer of sand on the surface of the pots so that the flies can't lay their eggs on the organic matter, you know, like peat-based potting soils, and then they burrow down in and feed on that and or feed on the roots. So that's one more of the ways. The Natrol is considered an organic pesticide and safe for use indoors. So you've got to be very careful about using any pesticides indoors.
Right, right. Okay. So if I've got a massive amount of springtails in my compost, should I just start over or should I just dry it out really well? Will they go away?
Normally not that much of a problem. They are doing, I mean, they are helping break down the organic matter into other nutrients. So, yeah, you can... If you're concerned about using your compost, you should be fine. You know, if you want to use it in your garden, if the compost is fairly well broken down, one can hope. Then go ahead and dig it into your soil. If you're digging holes for transplanting, you know, you can put a handful or a couple of handfuls or a shovel full underneath maybe zucchini plants or something like that, and then put some soil on top of that, and then your plants or seeds or seedlings on top of that.
Oh, okay.
So normally they aren't going to be too much of a problem as far as in your gardens to hurt things, and really are not a problem in compost. I mean, they are doing what, you know, all those different soil microorganisms, bacteria, fungi, are helping to break down things into so more of the nutrients are available than to plants to use.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So I didn't know if they were going to ruin my garden. So, okay. All right. Thank you.
All right.
You're
thank
welcome.
You. Thanks for calling.
Bye.
Bye. Ed, we were just talking about slugs. We can, you were just giving us some examples of what we could do about the slugs, the ammonia and water, and of course, there's always salt too, right?
Yeah, however, salt is a little more hazardous to other to other critters in the garden. Where the ammonia water, you spray it on the slugs. Now, you've got to be careful, too, if slugs are on plants already, what kind of plants you spray. If they're on something like a cabbage or a broccoli plant, which has very thick, waxy leaves, usually no big deal, it runs right off. you know, and the slug slides off with it. But on something like lettuce plants, which are much more tender, and even I've seen a fair number of aphids on potato plants too, if you're concerned about that, that you want to go a little lighter, and you can even to, if that's primarily what you're targeting or the kind of plants you're spraying, you might even dilute your ammonia a bit more, even go down to 1/4 ammonia to 3/4 water. Because you may get some browning of the leaves when you spray it on these thin leaves or these kind of fuzzy leaves like the potatoes are, or tomatoes, or even cucumbers if you're doing this in a greenhouse. So you want to be careful with that. But other stuff that you can use, you know, Sluggo or Worry Free, there's a couple of the safe slug baits. Corys is not so safe for other critters, and for birds and, well, dogs too. Where the Sluggo, I've watched birds eat it with no ill effects. But, again, with any of the slug baits you happen to be using, or your Deadline is another one that's quite hazardous.
Sure, yeah.
If you're going to use that stuff, you definitely want to cover it up, put it inside a container, or underneath old shingles, underneath bricks, or flat rocks, or something like that, or boards, where other animals can't get to it. So that's really important. Again, we're trying to target our pest as precisely as we can. You know, again, if you're squishing caterpillars between your thumb and forefinger, that's about as, or shooting the slugs with the ammonia, we know we're targeting just those pests. And that's why that's important to do that. Or if you're snipping them in half with an old pair of slug scissors, or skewering them for later pickling or whatever. There's your opportunity, Mindy, to make your first million, though, I think, is on the slug. Come up with some good slug recipes that you can promote around Southeast Alaska. And
yeah, we'll give
it
a try.
I'll taste it.
Yeah, okay. All right, well, I'll remember that. before we let you go, Ed, any tips for this week in gardening coming up on the weekend? Can we, let's see, we shouldn't be planting any radishes now or spinach, but maybe we could still plant some kale and anything else?
Oh, yeah, I've got on my kitchen table right now when I get home that I'm going to be planting peas. So edible potted peas are going to go in the ground for my late crop, like I mentioned. But yeah, any of the greens, potatoes can still be planted, carrots can still be planted, some of those turnips, rutabagas, that kind of stuff. Again, if you've got your remay handy and ready to cover it over immediately. And again, if you maybe on the 1st of May you put in some broccoli plants or something like that, you could start some more indoors potentially for transplanting. So again, so that once those broccoli, whatever is left, is all gone to flower, maybe by mid-July or late July, then you've got some new young ones coming along, so you can be eating broccoli and cauliflower and other good stuff into the fall. So again, you just keep planting stuff. Usually the most difficult thing, of course, is finding room to plant that stuff.
Right.
I know that's certainly my problem.
Okay, well, we'll be back with you again, Ed. Thanks for all of the great tips on pests today and for everyone who called in.
Yeah, you're very welcome, man. Yeah, make sure you keep the root maggots off with the remake, because that's certainly one of our other major pests, and that's the way to keep them from infesting and making the wormy radishes, turnips, rutabagas, and cauliflower, broccoli, cabbage, and more.
Okay, we'll talk to you later, Ed. Have a great time, and I'd be interested to hear about all of those ladybugs with the tree as well and see what kind of a job they do.
I'm going to try to go down and take a look at them here, so I'll try to give you a report next week.
Sounds great. Thank you.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Have a great day.
Ain't nothing in the world that I like better than bacon and lettuce and homegrown tomatoes. Up in the morning, out in the garden, get you ripe when you don't get a heart when you plant them in the spring.
Support for In the Garden comes from the Flower Farm, with a new shipment of marguerite daisies, colorful baskets, vegetables, perennials, and bedding plants. Also, trees, shrubs, and soil amendments. Open every day except Wednesday at 6 Rory Road, Papke's Landing.
Only two things that money can't buy, and that's true love and homegrown tomatoes. Well, you can go out to eat, and that's for sure, but it's nothing a homegrown tomato won't cure. Put them in a salad, put them in a stew. You can make your very own tomato juice. You can eat them with eggs, you can eat them with gravy. Eat them with beans, pinto or navy. Put them on a side, put them in the middle. Put a homegrown tomato on a hot cake griddle.